meteors disintegrate in place, and the way they disintegrate in place is that small pieces will fall off during windstorms.
Right.
Now, let's be fair. Some of them are large branches, and sometimes the crowns of the trees are pretty massive, and they will fall in a windstorm. So let's give the benefit of the doubt to the argument that someone could be hurt if one of these pieces
falls on them. But more
likely
if they're branches with leaves.
Right, because in windstorms, what mostly come down are the branches with leaves.
And the ones that don't have any leaves are not as big and strong. And it's And they don't have like a big, strong crown when they're completely dead and defoliated. The ones that they're supposed to be removing are the least dangerous in a windstorm.
Right, but to be fair, I mean, you could have a piece blow off of a dead hemlock during a windstorm that was heavy enough to hurt someone if the person was standing under the hemlock and the thing happened to land on them. But the problem with using that as an argument to cut down the tree, there's many problems as we've just discussed. One is that during windstorms, the park is closed. It's unlikely that there's going to be very many people in the park. Maybe a few people will sneak into the park. But, I mean, ethical question. Do we have an obligation to protect people who illegally sneak into the park when it's closed? So that's another matter. But
and clearly dangerous. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So are we going to cut down 130,000 trees in Stanley Park to protect you know, 16 people that illegally sneak into the park?
Right. And that's like killing the coyotes because somebody might go in and feed them. Drain the ocean because somebody might swim in a...
So it just seems a little bit unreasonable.
I guess we probably couldn't drain the ocean, but no, it's ludicrous. It's absurd. You know, the fact that we're going to completely destroy this beautiful landscape because a couple of dumbasses might grab a six pack and go down to the park in the middle of a really bad windstorm and sit under hemlock trees, after they've been advised not to do so.
Right, but
absurd.
Moreover, you know, the important thing here is that the empirical data shows from the November and December 2024 windstorms, as I said, that during a windstorm, almost all of what falls down onto trails and roads, almost all of that is not defoliated hemlocks, but healthy, living, green, foliated trees, and actually not mostly hemlocks, but mostly cedars.
Yeah. So why not cut down all the... Yeah,
so targeting defoliated hemlocks under this argument that they, you know, under the falling limb argument, it just irrational.
They would cut down all healthy trees and leave the dead hemlocks.
Yeah, it's just not a sound
argument. If they were trying to...
Yeah. So you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. Julian McGuire and I are talking about the logging operation in Stanley Park and the reasons given for it, and we're going through the premises in the arguments and we believe refuting many of the premises, which therefore render many of these arguments that are being used by the City of Vancouver to be not sound arguments. Okay, so now I want to talk about what I call the disease argument. The disease argument has premises like this. Hemlocks are susceptible to these periodic looper defoliation events. And the looper defoliation creates danger, as we've talked about, makes these trees dangerous. And another premise is that danger should be eliminated or reduced. Another premise, replacing the hemlocks in the forest... Replacing hemlocks as a species, replacing them with Douglas fir, red alder, and cedar. Those are the other three types of trees that the City of Vancouver said they want to, and the Parks Board said they want to replant with those trees after they cut down the hemlocks, that by doing so, that will decrease the looper defoliation, right? Because now they've eliminated the main food source for the loopers, which are hemlocks, and they replace them with Douglas fir, red alder, and cedar. And another premise is that danger, again, should be reduced. We need to eliminate or reduce danger. And the conclusion is, therefore, that hemlocks should be removed and they should be replaced with Douglas fir, red alder, and cedar. A valid argument, right? If the premises are true, the conclusion must be true. But is it sound, right? Are the premises true? So let's look at the premises in this disease argument. Are the hemlocks susceptible to periodic looper defoliation?
Yes.
I think we can agree to that, that that's true. The second premise, looper defoliation creates danger. Well, we refute that, and that's what we've discussed in the previous arguments.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, for at least most of my life, until probably very recently, I think I kind of bought into this narrative that insects are bad, you know, that when insects come around, they have to be eradicated, you know, like when the ants migrate or, you know, when a tree gets infested. But what we're learning is that's not true, that the insects are a huge part of our healthy ecosystems, and insects, you know, break things down in order to, and this looper moth breaks down these trees so that they start disintegrating, and then they feed the forest floor, right? So that they don't get, so that it's nature's way of not letting them get too old.
Right, and I purposely called it the disease argument because that's the way that the logging proponents, the contractor, the city of Vancouver, has presented the looper. They call it the looper moth. You know, when you look at the scientific literature.
Even the word infestation.
Right. They use the word infestation. They've made claims about it coming from some other place and spreading into Stanley Park, like coming from
invasive,
North Vancouver.
Yeah.
But the fact is that scientifically speaking, research readily shows that the looper is a native insect.
Yeah.
It's a part of the ecosystem.
It's doing its job. It's like the bees, you know, the bees that, you know, take, that pollinate our flowers. It takes one thing from another flower and gives it to another flower. These loopers provide a service to the forest. They defoliate a tree so it doesn't get too old, so it naturally degrades and it feeds the forest floor and provides valuable habitat for woodpeckers and bats. And all sorts of animals like to use these wildlife trees. And that's one of the things that Rhonda Milliken and Norm Oberson have been talking about. And actually, all of our experts talked about this, that these shouldn't be thought as dead trees. They should be rephrased as wildlife trees. They're not, they may be dead, but they're providing a valuable service. Just because an insect eats the leaves of a tree, it doesn't mean that that tree is diseased. Insects do not automatically, you know, mean that something has a disease, and they don't have to be eradicated. So we're so obsessed with taking down trees that have bugs in them, using pesticides on trees that have bugs in them. And it's so entrenched in our colonial mindsets.
An understanding of ecology is quite different than this concept that's been promoted by the City of Vancouver and the forestry contractor. You know, they look at these trees as like stagnant, like atomized things in a forest that can be just removed.
Yeah.
But actually they're interrelated to the entire ecological health of the forest and the ecosystem. The forest is a system, and the looper is merely a part of the system, and it serves the purpose of defoliating trees and making them better wildlife trees.
Yeah.
So what happens is that the many species of birds, especially like the pileated woodpecker, pileated woodpecker creates like cavities in the trunks of trees, which it makes home.
It
and then
there.
When it's done, other species of birds come and live there and reuse them for many years, because the pileated woodpecker is very strong and can dig deep into trees and make these big cavities that smaller birds can't make. But the pileated woodpecker is very skilled at picking out trees that are dead or dying because the wood in the tree becomes more malleable, and they can make the nest. So the pileated woodpecker will not make a nest in a in a tree that's you know, young and alive and everything. They look for these.
So again, it thanks the looper moth for creating this tree that they can make their home in.
You know, but we have to be careful because we're doing a little bit of unwittingly adopting some of the terminology that has been used by the logging proponents to promote the logging. And it's funny how this happens. This is actually another philosophical issue, maybe a linguistic issue, which we can talk about another time, which is language is very important, right?
Yeah.
So you pointed out correctly that the proponents of logging use the word infestation to convey
dead.
The idea dead, right, rather than snags, right?
So right. Snags or wildlife trees,
right?
Not even snags,
right.
They're wildlife trees.
Right.
They're
so
important.
Dead trees implies that they're worthless, that they're gone, done, cycle's over. But actually, they're still in a very important part of the cycle.
Yeah.
But another example is looper moth. So if you look at the scientific literature, it's called the Western hemlock looper. The moth part, I believe, has been added by logging proponents to make it sound ugly.
Because moths eat your sweaters.
Right. And moths have a negative, ugly, useless, connotation. But actually,
the
looper is like a little caterpillar. And it, I think at a certain stage in its development, in a late stage, it's moth-like. But
it eats when it's a caterpillar.
Right. When it's a caterpillar, it's actually this very pretty little green, little shiny green, little cute little caterpillar. Right.
Like the hungry caterpillar that we all read that children's book that's really, really, really popular.
Right.
The hungry caterpillar. That's why they can't call it a caterpillar, because the kids are like, no, we love the caterpillars. The caterpillars are cute.
Right.
But moths are ugly. They eat your sweaters.
Right. So we're touching upon one of the strategies used by proponents of the logging.
I wonder
if
they sit and have this conversation, if they're like, we got to call it a moth, because if we call it a caterpillar, people build.
I think so.
They have this conversation. What's more threatening?
They have marketing people, and they know that terminology is very important. So they say we need to use the word moth. We need to use the word infestation. We need to use the word dead trees. And in fact, it works for many people because...
Deadly.
Yeah, because when we talk to people on the street who are not informed and don't know... They say, well, what do you mean the trees are dead? What's wrong with cutting down dead trees? They're already dead anyway.
Yeah. And that's what people do in their yard. Like, I know I've had... We have a dead tree, a dead-ish tree in my backyard. It's a plum tree. And I have a great disagreement with my husband because he's like, it's dead. We got to cut it down. I'm like, no, the birds love being in that tree. They love that tree more than the live apple tree that's right next to it. They love it. So I've been able to save that tree.
Right. So, if we adopt, a more educated ecological understanding of a forest, then we see that there is a cyclical process going on where trees, they germinate, they sprout, they grow. All trees eventually will die. And in that phase, when they are dead or dying, they are very valuable and they play an important part in the forest ecosystem. And it's very uneducated and ignorant, actually.
Well, and capitalistic,
to think you should just cut them down.
And it's capitalism, too. And this Western capitalist mentality of, like, if something is dying and we can still cut it down and make some money off it, then that's what we're going to do. Right, because there's obviously when something has degraded to 3/4 of the way down, you're not going to be cut it up. You're not going to be able to mill it and sell it, right? But these defoliated hemlock trees are providing a good amount of wood.
Right. So the disease argument, In our view, really is not a sound argument. Mostly because the looper is not a disease; it's simply an important and integral part of the forest system, of the ecological system. It plays a role, and it's not a bad, a bad little pest. It's just eating. I mean, you eat, I eat, we all eat. It's just eating. It's doing its thing. So much for the disease argument, we believe. So there's the financial argument, and this has been made as a legal argument, which is that the first premise is that defoliated trees will be falling and or becoming more dangerous in coming months and years. Similar premise to some of the other arguments. As they fall, or become more dangerous, they will require closing all or parts of the park. So the argument goes that these trees that are defoliated will be falling, and they're going to fall across roads, or they're going to have to move heavy equipment in on roads in order to clear out the trees that are falling and deteriorating over the coming 2, 3, 5, 10 years. And there's going to be these continual closures, these periodic right. closures of the park. And the next premise in the argument is that when all or parts of the park are closed, there will be millions of dollars in financial losses to park businesses. So,
like the tea house.
Yeah, so in court, the...
Where people walk to in windstorms.
Right. So the financial people for the city came in with all this data, with all these predictions yeah. about how many millions of dollars would be lost if the park were closed for, you know, for a week or for a month or whatever. And, you know, and they really showed that millions of dollars could be lost because there's all these businesses in the park right. and...
Let's take all the trees out and pave it, and then people won't want to go there.
Well, that's not the argument, but
no.
yeah,
you're right.
being facetious, yeah. But the argument, the financial argument, goes that financial losses must be prevented. So these financial losses,
right.
which will inevitably occur when the trees inevitably fall,
yeah.
Must be prevented. And right. therefore, the trees should be cut down now, all in one time, which is what they're doing, right?
Yeah.
So there's not this like continual periodic closures many areas over the coming years. So let's just get it all over with now. And that's a big argument that was made in court by the city. And maybe people buy that argument. But so what's wrong with that argument? Well, many of these premises are just wrong. So we've already established that defoliated trees will not be falling.
But also... like, just because you close a trail now, it's not going to be more inconvenient or take longer if you close that trail next year or the year after.
Right. So you can question the logic of that.
You can spread, you know, it might be the tea house is affected one year. And the horse and cart is affected another year, and Prospect Point is affected another year. But really, all that's been affected are the trails. None of the businesses have lost any money because people haven't been able to go to the park. It's all just trails that have been closed.
Right, but what the argument goes, to be fair to their argument, is that this is going to be an increasing problem, right?
But why would it be an increasing?
Well, because the trees are deteriorating over time. It's going to get worse, right? That's the argument, is that the dead trees... which are defoliated in this most recent looper cycle, will be deteriorating at an increasing rate over the next 10 years, and there'll be more and more trees falling on the road and on the trails, requiring closures. That's the argument.
Right. It still really doesn't make any sense, because we know that the trees that have leaves are more likely to fall. So. Why would they remove the dead trees if the live trees are more likely to fall?
Right. So those premises are, similar to the same premises in the previous argument.
If they were true, they're
not,
it would be a logical argument. But they're not true. They're manufactured reasons. So it's almost like, you know, the city of Vancouver and a logging company just decided that for some reason they want to log Stanley Park, and then figured out the reasons to do it, or there was an opportunity.
I wanted to talk about this other premise, that financial losses must be prevented, because that's actually a really interesting premise. So, I mean, is that really true? Isn't that sort of like a value judgment?
Well, if financial losses must be prevented, then we would be taking action on climate immediately, because it's well known that it's going to cost billions and billions of dollars.
Even if it were true that there would be financial losses by not conducting this logging operation, which we refute that.
Right.
But even if it were true, it's an interesting concept that the park should be logged out to minimize or prevent financial losses. What about the loss of the forest? Isn't there a value?
Yeah.
I mean, saying that there's a that the cash received on a daily or weekly or monthly basis by businesses in the park or by the city generating revenue from tourism or from parking fees or whatever, that somehow that's quantifiable and that has value, but that there's no value
in having a beautiful forest.
Yeah, and retaining this forest, which has been preserved for 125 years.
Why have a piece of art
Vancouver became a city?
Why have a beautiful piece of art in your house if you can't have a Rembrandt? You know, if it's not worth anything. Yeah, it's crazy. But even if it were true, even if we believed in this rampant capitalistic mindset, the reason a lot of people come to Vancouver is because Stanley Park is world famous, because they can go into this beautiful forest. And we have cycling companies that rent bikes so that they can go through the park. We have tours that go through that talk about the ecosystem of the park. So it's just not true that you know, maybe a tree might fall over in front of the Prospect Point Cafe and it, I don't even know. I'm sure people could just take another route to the Prospect Point Cafe. It's just not true.
Kind of putting everything together now, right? So the trees are defoliated, they're dying, they're going to deteriorate, they're going to fall. And when they fall, they're going to hurt people and or close roads and trails, which will cause parts of the park to have to be closed, which will cause these massive financial losses. So that's their argument. I think we've refuted, debunked many of the premises involved in that argument. But
yeah, what's the value of a spiritual experience, right? Yeah,
even if it were all true, couldn't you make the argument that, well, maybe there'll have to be some financial losses in order to protect something that cannot be assigned a monetary value, which is this native, partially old growth, semi-wild forest, which has been preserved, sort of preserved, right in the backyard of an urban area of Vancouver, which provides this immense value, not a dollar value.
And these beautiful animals that live in there. Like, how beautiful is it to see an eagle? You know, see a bald eagle flying and landing in a tree, or an owl. Like when kids are in a park and they spot an owl, like that's the most magical thing. And you know, kids used to have that experience a lot, and it's diminishing. It's decreasing the availability of that experience, and it's really tragic. So, if I have, you know, well, I do have children. And especially when they were young, they loved going out in nature. They loved seeing animals. You know, kids, frogs are going extinct. Amphibians are going extinct across the world. I don't see frogs in Stanley Park. I'm sure there once were frogs in Stanley Park. You know, that experience for children is priceless. You can't put a monetary amount on an experience of a child seeing an owl.
Right, so what you're touching on now is an issue in environmental ethics. So I can talk about that a little bit to sort of sum up this whole issue here around the Stanley Park logging, which is that nature, to an environmental ethicist, has different types of value. We've been talking about mostly today, we've been talking about the instrumental value of nature. What is the value of nature to people? How do people benefit or not benefit by nature? So when we talk about all of these arguments, why trees should be cut down in Stanley Park, they pose a danger to people. They might result in, if we don't cut them down, there'll be financial losses. This is all in relation to people. How do the trees, how does the forest benefit or not benefit, threaten or not threaten humans? So that's the general, those considerations all fall into the general umbrella of instrumental value of nature. But there's another type of value that nature has, which is intrinsic value. So more and more,
like
moral, moral ethicists, environmental ethicists are recognizing that nature has an intrinsic value independent of whether it serves or doesn't serve humans. Yeah. And our legal system in here in Canada and in Western countries just mostly does not recognize the intrinsic value of nature, although that may be changing slowly. There's a few countries where they're starting to that's starting to get into their legal system. I think some of the Scandinavian countries.
Yeah, well, and we do have Ian Edwards, who I've worked with on pensions, has started, I don't know if it's a society, but definitely a website called the Bank of Nature. And I think a lot of what he does with that is, even this is in economics, right? Create a nature, you know, a value of a healthy ecosystem. And it way outvalues like our fossil fuel or logging industry, right? These temporary sunset industries that are not sustainable. We need to find ways to do them sustainably because it has such a cost to the human experience.
And as soon as we talk about human experience, we are getting into the instrumental value. However, you know,
let's say somebody wanted to buy your child or your wife, and you know, financially, you know, if you were just looking at everything financially, well, of course you would sell those things. Right. But that's, everybody would agree that that's completely unethical to sell your child or your wife for money. Well, why is it okay to sell a beautiful ecosystem or just to go in and destroy a beautiful ecosystem so a few people could profit? It's insane. It's psychopathic.
If we look back at the history of Western culture, mm-hmm. and I'm saying Western, like European Western, because it's a different situation if we look at some of the indigenous cultures or Eastern culture, but Western culture, European culture, not that long ago, did not recognize intrinsic value of women, mm-hmm. did not recognize intrinsic value of people of color. Mm-hmm. It's only recently, like in the last couple hundred years, that the what we call in environmental ethics the circle of concern. So the circle of concern did not used to include anything but white males. Mm-hmm. So the United States was founded by white male landowners, and the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and all that applied to white male landowners.
Yeah, it's like a very, very exclusive club.
Right. But the circle of moral concern, of ethical concern, has been growing even in Western culture.
And now we're at animals and trees. There are still cusp, right?
Yeah, so although it's not uniform, and there's been some regression, I think, especially if you look at the world politics right now and the politics in the United States with Trump and the reemergence of racism, of outright racism, there's been some backtracking. But in general, there's been a trend for this circle of moral concern to be expanded to include women, to include minorities, to include people of different sexual orientations, non-binary people, and there's a lot of pushback against that, right? That people don't, some people don't like.
They're, white men don't like it.
They don't like it, right? And but there's this energy.
Like
there's been this energy toward expanding the circle of concern, and there's also now the idea that we need to include nature within this circle of concern, and not just of concern, but of intrinsic value.
Yeah.
So women have intrinsic value. People that are black or indigenous have intrinsic value.
Right, as much intrinsic value as white males have,
Right, and And so animals have intrinsic value. Mm-hmm. The forest ecosystem has intrinsic value,
right,
whether or not it serves people. Okay, well, thank you very much, Jillian McGuire. I'm Michael Robert Kaditz. We are directors of the Stanley Park Preservation Society. We are fighting to preserve Stanley Park, and we've been talking about and analyzing some of the arguments that are put forth why this current massive logging operation should be taking place. Yeah. And we believe that we've countered many of the premises involved in their arguments, and the science and the ethics simply, we believe, do not support this logging operation. Thank you very much, Jillian.
If any loggers come to your town talking about sick, dead trees, all right, bye.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
We're from the Kiwassa Preteen Spring Camp. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Campus Community Radio from Simon Fraser University on Burnaby Mountain.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn.